Well, guys, apologies for the somewhat late-ish introduction. Specifically, as just recognized, you know, I was using the wrong mic. But good morning, good morning, good morning. Welcome to my Sunday morning take here on this lovely December morning. Specifically, obviously, this being the first Sunday morning session in the month of December. We are pretty close to getting into the holiday habits of you, the rest of the Namibians in the country, specifically as a lot of you probably would be targeting this coming week's 10th of December. I almost said 10th of August, my goodness. But 10th of December, a particular public holiday. I know what's going through your heads, guys. Don't worry. I know how you Namibians act. The moment you see a public holiday, specifically one strategically positioned within the middle of a week, it immediately signals to your brain and your family members at that stage, hey, you know what? Let's make it a long weekend. In Afrikaans, you know, I had a boss that used to say, a lank naweek, meaning it's, instead of it being just a long weekend, it becomes a long weekend. Obviously, you know, English doesn't have the same particular carry-on flavor as what your mother tongue sometimes has. So, welcoming you to this particular session of my Sunday morning take, specifically where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, to help us understand specifically what's going on in certain developments happening around the world, and primarily what this signals to the rest of us. This particular morning session helps us understand a specific, if you can call it a celebration somewhat, because in the realm of obviously African advancements, it's not there, except for just one African country being present on this particular continent, that being South Africa. And the particular advancements obviously were mostly based upon being the first to reach this particular point. Now, this morning's discussion is about the South Pole, meaning Antarctica. And if you did not know, there are technically four different kinds of South Poles. I'll share them. Just so that you know, primarily what this particular conversation was about. Because on the 14th of December, not long from here, or not far from here, a gentleman by the name of Raoul Amundsen, yes, he's Norwegian, arrived at the South Pole. This is on 14 December 1911. I actually watched a documentary about a British expedition that took forever to get to the same point that Amundsen only trained for a very long time and got there on his first try. The particular British expedition actually saw, you know, first and foremost, they came from a completely different side of the continent of Antarctica. Obviously, they didn't scout the entire shoreline to see which was the best place to land at. However, for Amundsen and his particular expeditionary team, what they did is they trained extensively because they're from Norway, and Norway has an Arctic part of it. If you did not know, part of Norway's geography is technically part of the Arctic Shelf, which is the North Pole landmass, meaning that's ice as well as also land that had been frozen so severely you technically can't have any particular agriculture or think of having any particular agriculture on it. And he trained extensively just to prepare for the South Pole. Now, you'd be asking, so, you know, this obviously means that Amundsen, you know, just was a little bit more dedicated in his training exercises, whereas the English or the British expeditions were primarily, firstly, they were sailors. They were not, like actual explorers. They were sailors. These guys were, much of their work and much of their career was based on the sea. So they were sailors. So Amundsen is identified as one of the greatest figures in the history of polar exploration, because as a Norwegian explorer, he left Norway for the Antarctica in June of 1910. And on this particular day of 14 December, which is at the end of this, next week, next week, Sunday, In 1911, he became the first person to reach the South Pole. How they obviously did this, well, it's a little bit weird how they actually did this. Now, the discussion, obviously, of what Amundsen did, as well as also the other expeditionary force that I mentioned, the British expeditionary force that Amundsen actually beat, without him actually knowing that he was in an actual competition to beat them, or that they actually knew that he was also there, because no one knew that the other side was there, until the British expedition rocked up at Amundsen's, his particular position, where he had indicated his, that he had come here, and you write down your name, and you put something up there, it's a little structure. And all Amundsen did was turn around and head back to the ship. You know, he and his team. Now, when you obviously see this particular scenario of who actually discovers a place, technically, this makes Antarctica a little bit of a peculiar discussion. This is not the similarities with regards to how, you know, colonialism spread, or how the subjugation of peoples from different cultures or different ethnicities or different skin colors actually also occur. It's similar, but not similar. Reason being is because the assumption was clear and straightforward that potentially there was already, you know, a landmass to the south of Africa, of South America, and of Australasia. Now, if you did not know, guys, if you've ever looked at the world map with the equator drawn through it in its actual position, what you will sometimes discover is that there are a lot less people in the southern hemisphere than in the northern hemisphere. Secondly, on top of this, is that in the southern hemisphere, there's also a weird discussion between the weather regarding how our weather gets influenced by the South Pole, as well as also the particular discussion in terms of the distances between the various continents and their proximities also to Antarctica. If you've ever seen a map, if you've ever gone and looked at a global map, you would realize that Antarctica in some cases is illustrated as this massive white mass at the bottom of your map. And the Arctic, the North Pole, is illustrated by this other smaller mass of white, to illustrate, obviously, the ice element at the top of the map. But in many cases, primarily, you don't actually get to see the actual size of the continent. The actual depiction of what it looks like, as well as also what this particular continent still, what role it still plays in the modern-day era, specifically in, well, 2025 going ahead, and so on. Now, right after this, the small musical break that we'll be stepping into right now, we'll be getting into that particular conversation regarding the South Pole and where the actual poles are. Because remember, just like with the North Pole, you get a magnetic pole, you get a true pole, you get another pole, and then you sometimes get one that's slightly off course entirely, which is the same scenario also in this regard for the South Pole. And on that note, dear listeners, we'll be back right after this short musical break.
Baby, I'ma want you. Baby, I'ma need you. You're the only one I care enough to hurt about. Maybe I'm a crazy, but I just can't live without your loving and affection, giving me direction, like a guiding light to help me through my darkest hour. Lately I'm a praying that you'll always be a staying beside me. Used to be my life was just emotions passing by, feeling all the while I never really knowing why. I'm a praying that you'll always be a staying beside me. Used to be my life was just emotions passing by. Then you came along and made me laugh and made me cry. You taught me why, baby, I'm gonna want you. Baby, I'ma need you. For it took so long to find you, baby. Baby, I'ma want you. Baby, I'ma need you.
Coming back there from the sound specifically of Bread with the song, Baby, I'ma Want You. I hope I said that properly. And obviously this brings us up about close to the 5:30 mark here on your number one talk radio station. And this is my Sunday morning take, where you're in my company from 5 a.m. up and until 7 a.m. And obviously where we left off in our discussion for this morning was based upon the discussions around the interest of the South Pole. Now, I highlighted who discovered. Yes, I'm sorry for using that word, but primarily that is the word that the particular, you know, literature resources have all cited. The aspect of discovery, as well as also the aspect of firstly claiming who got there first. So, after Amundsen's particular discovery in 1911, or his particular sort of like staking a claim in 1911, on 14 December, there's actually been an indication of how many South Poles we actually have. Now, bear with me, guys. They all have different names. So you get the South Geographic Pole, which might seem to be in the middle of the map of the continent, but it's technically in the middle of the latitude lines, that you see. The longitude and the latitude, actually it's the longitude lines. Then you get the South Magnetic Pole, and then you get the South Geomagnetic Pole, and then there is the South Pole of Inaccessibility. So, primarily the one that was, if I can say, laid claim to by Amundsen, was primarily the one closest to the South Pole of Inaccessibility. Reason being, as well as also the discussion about, you know, how they got there. Well, firstly, it's the South Geographic Pole. And then there was obviously the South Pole of Inaccessibility, because there are certain parts of the South Pole of Antarctica that you sometimes cannot even access. Firstly, it's weird things like mountain formations, rock formations, certain particular aspects of landscape that just look weird, that you don't find anywhere else on the planet, that no one else has seen on the planet, and it's only seen on this particular single continent, as well as also trying to understand which is the true point of South. Now, the South Pole, which is also known as the geographic South Pole, or the terrestrial South Pole, is the point in the southern hemisphere where the Earth's axis of rotation meets its surface. So that's the first particular point. It is called the true South Pole to distinguish from the South Magnetic Pole. And the South Magnetic Pole is the pole, is the point of the pole, or technically, is the pole, yes, let me stay there, is the pole that's not on the continent. The Magnetic Pole, the South Magnetic Pole. It's the same, not the same story with the North, with the Magnetic North Pole. Because you also get the same particular distinctions. If you ever, guys, have ever picked up a compass, for those of you that ever have ever played with a compass before, you would have always seen that the dial of the compass never points to north-north. It always gets pulled to magnetic north, meaning it's slightly off the 12 o'clock. If you think about the hands of a clock, it's slightly off the 12 o'clock, meaning it's like 5 minutes to 12. to that particular point, but it's literally between the 11 o'clock and the 12 o'clock indications. That's where magnetic north always points to. Now, this could be the similar situation because most compasses have never designed to show you South Pole. Just so that you guys know, most your compasses are not designed to show south. They're designed to show north. So it makes things a bit weird in terms of understanding that the magnetic South Pole, which is not on the continent itself of Antarctica. Now, the South Pole is by definition also the southernmost point on Earth because it literally lies antipodally. antipodes are obviously the opposite ends of any spot on the planet. So meaning any spot directly opposite the other spot that you're measuring is what this term antipodally means. And the interesting thing is obviously that no time zone has also been assigned to the South Pole. So any time can be used as local time. Anyone can impose a time window or time frames or, what's that term that we get? Yeah, it's time frames. You can impose any particular time on the South Pole itself. So this also makes things particularly interesting because, firstly, and this is the next particular point we'll be getting into, is that there's a whole bunch of countries that lay claim to the South Pole. We have to be lucky that one of them is an African country, i.e. South Africa, but in many particular cases, it's a particularly weird discussion because many of these countries are in different time zones themselves. So thus making things a little bit weird when you think about the imposition of a time zone on this continent. We also get an interesting particular scenario as clockwise movements is east, specifically in terms of how the continent moves, meaning how it follows the rotation of the Earth. So if you think about it, you find a landmass at the southernmost point of the Earth, and you've got to ask yourself the particular question, how does direction flow? Meaning, does the sun go rise in the east and set in the west, like we all see every day? Or is it a discussion of, there is actually no sunset and sunrise discussions. There's just overcast and clear sky days. And with the sun technically being there. So the discussion that is sometimes given is that what has been observed is that along the tight latitude circles that obviously the South Pole finds itself in, is that clockwise movement is east and counterclockwise movement is west. The South Pole is at the center of the southern hemisphere. It's literally at the center. And it's situated on its own particular continent known as Antarctica, and it's the site of the U.S. Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. So just to let you know, the second name, Scott, of the Amundsen Station that the Americans positioned there was the British expedition that failed. Well, they were on the verge of failing when they found that Amundsen already got there like a day or 2 days before them. And this particular station itself, which was established in 1956, has also been permanently staffed ever since 1956. Now, because the South Pole is covered by an ice sheet roughly 3.2 kilometers thick, 3,200 meters thick, that is how thick this ice sheet is. And this ice sheet is a slow-moving ice sheet. The geographic marker must be moved several meters each year. Also, buildings slowly become buried in snow because it does not melt. The snow never melts, meaning it perpetually snows in the South Pole. And that there is a marker at the geographic South Pole that has to be placed there each year. And also a ceremonial South Pole that has to be marked with various flags and a special post. All of these things obviously have to be indicated by the scientists that are stationed there. If you guys didn't know, yes, it's only scientists that are stationed there. So, we get into some of the particular scenarios, because the scenarios that that emanate from this has been who actually lays claim to this particular continent. Now, if you guys did not know, and I only also discovered this recently, is that there is a treaty known as the Antarctic Treaty. So the Antarctic Treaty is a Cold War era treaty. It was a treaty specifically because the American president at the time, Dwight D. Eisenhower, my namesake, became worried that the Cold War would literally spill over to this particular continent, this continent that is not inhabited by any humans. It's the only uninhabited continent on Earth, just so that you guys know. It's the only uninhabited continent on Earth. And the concerns were that literally, you know, the geopolitical situations of the 50s, the 60s would obviously spill over to this particular place. And he invited all sides, to meetings, specifically in Washington, D.C., so that they can iron out a treaty that specifically sets out, you know, what can be done, what cannot be done, how conduct, you know, how various countries need to conduct themselves when participating in various particular scientific activities on this continent. So as I've mentioned, guys, the treaty's actual name is the Antarctic Treaty System, or just the Antarctic Treaty. It's also a particular treaty, just so that you know, that factors into other international ownership treaties that exist out there. For example, the Law of the Sea, the Outer Space Treaty, the Moon Treaty, and the International Waters Treaty. Remember that, obviously, you know, Antarctica itself is not a landmass that just floats there somewhere in the sky and, you know, it's not subject to any other particular multilateral or international treaties. And that has been one of the interesting things that I've observed in many cases, specifically that the multilateral treaties are there specifically to guide the conduct of nations when they have to deal with each other. These are things that you can find, for example, from the World Trade Organization Treaty, even to the, but it has a different name, that WTO or treaties. It's known as some, it's almost said the Fair Trade Treaty, but it's not that name. And then obviously also these other particular treaties that exist around the world. Now, one particular major, if I can call it, lack of involvement on the African scene, which is only, actually being pursued actively, by the South Africans, is the airspace. Anything above, you know, in your skies. So the airspace or the aeronautical or whatever term you wish to use for the space above, you know, the skies above your country, are crucial, because this particularly speaks towards the various particular developments as well as also security components and developments that can be utilized to look after your airspace. Now, since we are looking at a discussion that is bound by a treaty, has particular sort of like aspects or facets that govern or actually guides the conduct of nations, primarily when they interact with this landmass. And so that you know, there is animal life on Antarctica. Just so that you know, there is animal life. It's just, it's uninhabited, meaning there are no humans that live there. Just so that you know. So, when this particular scenario is, you know, is one that brought together all these particular countries, It is an interesting development that actually spawns from it. But I have to explain to you what the Antarctic Treaty is all about. So the Antarctic Treaty is a treaty that's part of other related agreements that I highlighted a little bit earlier. And collectively, it is known as the Antarctic Treaty System. So all these treaties together with the Antarctic Treaty make up this Antarctic Treaty System. It's there to regulate international relations with respect to the Antarctica. which is Earth's only continent without a native human population. It was the first arms control agreement established during the Cold War, and it helped to designate the continent as a scientific preserve. So, what does that actually speak of? The whole continent was viewed as you would view Etosha, technically, as a game, you know, as a nature reserve or as a, you know, as a conservation area. So this whole continent is viewed as one massive preserved ecosystem. Now, it helped to establish the freedom of scientific investigation, this treaty, and it helped to ban military activity from taking place on this particular place. And this is primarily for the purposes of the treaty system. The Antarctica is also defined as all the land and ice shelves south of 60 degrees latitude. Since September 2004, the Antarctic Treaty Secretariat, which implements the treaty system, is headquartered in Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires. Now, the main treaty was opened for signature on 1 December of 1959, and it officially entered into force on 23 June 1961. The original signatories were the 12 countries that were active in Antarctica during the International Geophysical Year of 1957 to 1958. If you're going to ask me what that International Geophysical Year actually was it was also referred to as the Third International Polar Year, and it was an international scientific project that lasted from 1 July 1957 to 31 December 1958. And it marked the end of a long period during the Cold War when scientific interchange between East and West primarily, and obviously when we say between East and West, we're talking obviously between the Soviet-influenced area and the Western-influenced areas primarily, had been seriously interrupted. So what this technically meant was that obviously there was great distrust, there was great suspicion between both sides, just like we're seeing currently today, even with the geopolitics that is influencing everything from trade, everything specifically to the movement of people, even to the particular aspects of just trying to identify how to get development going for partner countries in various particular global settings, primarily so as to help each other achieve their specific developmental goals. So you see this particular scenario in terms of the discussion based on what actually exists out there specifically and how this treaty governs the actions of the other continents, meaning where people actually live. So the participants to this treaty: Argentina, Australia, Belgium, Chile, France, Japan, New Zealand, Norway, South Africa, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and the United States. These countries had established over 55 Antarctic research stations within that particular year, the International Geophysical Year. And the subsequent promulgation of the treaty was seen as a diplomatic expression of the operational and scientific cooperation that had been achieved. Now, as of 2024, the treaty has so far reached 58 parties, meaning 58 member states. And this obviously indicates towards the particular indication of what could happen. One of the most notable developments that actually came out in recent years, so I'm talking about the last 2 to 3 to 5 years, was specifically the discussion or the news reports that came through from South Africa when one team member of the South African delegation that was sent to their research station on the Antarctica, on the South Pole, had become violent and had also assaulted like two or three group members, specifically on the station, on the South Pole, which had created a little bit of a diplomatic scenario because the South African station sent out distress calls, and a distress call is sometimes something that you try to assess whether or not how severe the particular emergency sometimes is. So, just so that you know, that was one of the particular major developments that came out of the past 2 years. Anything else that you're reading, I just have to let you know, you have to take it with a pinch of salt. Sometimes it's major internet clickbait that they're trying to attract you with. For example, like the possibility of some sort of alien species or ship or spaceships and UFOs and, you know, large animals, species that were supposedly found there. I'll tell you now, your guess is as good as mine. However, if you're not part of any of the scientists there on the South Pole, on the Antarctica, you would not actually know what the research is that is being conducted there or what discoveries have been made there. I'll let you know that that's the best secret I can let you in on. Anything else that you try to read up and anything else that tries to lock you in with some sort of sensationalist headline somewhere in terms of the media reporting is clickbait, and it's just there literally to waste your time, because it's not even misinformation. It doesn't even tell you what is being discovered. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we're going to take a short musical break, and after that break, we're going to come back heading into the rest of this morning's program here on your number one talk radio station. This is My Sunday Morning Take. You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday.
Changed. I lost my vision, but I'm coming of age now. Well, at some stage, I changed my mind over a bottle of cheap wine. I'll fix myself up when the moment's right. Just not tonight. Say a prayer into my drink. I think about you more than I should. Would I fade into the solar system if I left my neighborhood? Stay now. I was looking for a real soft landing. Hey now. All I wanted was some understanding. Cause I don't wanna work the room tonight. I just wanna be by your side when it all unfolds. When it all unfolds, I know that we weren't always on the same page. Well, I guess the truth is I was bruised in the first place. From the first day, if I let down my guard now. Well, I don't wanna get my hopes up every time I get too close. I'm trying to shake my tunnel vision, cause I think about you more than I should. Fade into the solar system if I could. If I could. Stay now. I was looking for a real soft landing. Hey now. All I wanted was some understanding. Cause I don't wanna work the room tonight. I just wanna be by your side. When it all unfolds. When it all unfolds. Say a prayer to my drink. I think about you more than I should. Would I fade into the solar system if I left my neighborhood? I think about you more. Stay now. I was looking for a real soft landing. Hey
Let's take our time.
Right there were the sounds of the group Take That with the song We've Got All Day. Before that, you heard the old group that George Michael was part of, known as Wham, with one of the Freedom songs that he wrote. The first one is obviously that one from the 80s, specifically with his band members. And the second one was the other Freedom that I could not technically play because I have a sneaky suspicion there might be something foul in it. And specifically this, but that, yeah, just giving a little bit of history of those two Freedom songs that George Michael wrote himself. And then, before that, it was the song from St. Raymond with the song Soft Landing. Now, it brings you up to the midway point of this morning's discussion here on your favorite stage station, that being Eagle FM, and specifically, it is the midway point of 6 a.m. You're in my company from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m., and we get into the most interesting part in terms of the second half of our discussion for this morning, based upon the exploration scenarios. Now, remember the Norwegian that I mentioned, Amundsen, and the British expedition Scott that also took place. His name is... being that there's been a considerable amount of exploration activities that were being conducted in order to, actually explore this particular part of, the Earth. Now, there's also been a whole bunch of movies being made, in that scenario. Obviously, for some reason, there's always one bright spark producer out there that decides, let's try and make a movie of man versus nature. It's always a man versus nature situation. I don't know why. I don't know why people like making such movies, but there's always this man versus nature situation, always ongoing. And if you've seen any of those particular man versus nature movies, it's always out there somewhere in the bush or somewhere in a scenario where the individual actually placed themselves in harm's way, specifically. However, for our discussion, we're going to be a little bit more based, and we're going to be a little bit more closer to the realities that exist. So, getting back, and before I actually venture into the discussion of the early parts of the Antarctic Treaty, because our discussion is not actually about the Antarctic Treaty, just so that you know that there is a historic monument that was installed on the South Pole to recognize Amundsen and his particular expedition. The expedition of 1911. It's known as Amundsen's tent, and it was a tent that was erected by the Norwegian expedition that was led by Roald Amundsen on its arrival on 14 December 1911. Now, it is buried beneath the snow and in the ice in the vicinity of the pole itself, and it has been designated as a historic site or a monument on the particular continent. This following a proposal by Norway to the Antarctic Treaty Consultative Meeting. Now, the precise location of the tent is actually unknown, obviously because of, you know, the volatile situation on this continent. But based on the calculations of the rate of movement of the ice and the accumulation of snow, it is believed as of 2010 to lie between 1.8 and 2.5 kilometers from the pole at a depth of 17 meters below the existing surface. So just so that you know, it's about 2 kilometers, almost 3 kilometers away from the pole itself, but that it's actually submerged already because the tent was forgotten there. Then you've also got another monument that was installed there, was the Argentine flagpole. This was as Argentine soldiers or Argentinian soldiers landed in 1965. This was a flagpole that was erected on the South Geographical Pole in December of 1965 by the first Argentine Overland Polar Expedition that has been designated as a historic site or monument following a proposal by Argentina also to the same consultative meeting at the same treaty platform. But all this obviously indicates, you know, the notions of exploration and being to be able to get there and erect some sort of a small monument situation. So we get to the actual exploration activity that was conducted. Now, pre-1900, in 1820, several expeditions claimed to have been the first to have sighted Antarctica, with the first being the Russian expedition led by Fabian Gottlieb von Bellingshausen and Mikhail Lazarev. The first landing was probably just a year later when an English-born American captain, John Davis, who was a sealer is these guys that hunt seals, set foot on the ice. And the basic geography of Antarctica's coastline was not understood until the mid to late 19th century, meaning they needed a cartographer. A cartographer is someone that literally goes and draws a map about what they see the land to be like. Yeah. Just so that you know. Now, an American naval officer by the name of Charles Wilkes claimed, supposedly correctly, that Antarctica was a new continent, basing this claim on his exploration in 1839 to 1840, while another explorer by the name of James Clark Ross, in his expedition of 1839 to 1843, hoped that he might be able to sail all the way to the South Pole, but he was unfortunately unsuccessful. So we get to the 1900s to 1950 period. Now, if you guys remember the British explorer that I mentioned that was beaten to the actual sort of like designation of saying this is the South Pole by the Norwegian Amundsen. That guy's name was Robert Falcon Scott. So the British explorer Robert Falcon Scott on the Discovery Expedition of 1901 to 1904 was the first to attempt to find a route from the Antarctic coastline to the South Pole. Now Scott, who was accompanied by Ernest Shackleton and Edward Wilson, set out with the aim of traveling as far south as possible, and on 31 December 1902, reached the following coordinates of 82 degrees, 16 minutes south, obviously in this particular attempt. Remember this particular attempt. There was another attempt that they had to make, or that they made. And Shackleton later on returned to Antarctica as leader of the British Antarctic Expedition, known as the Nimrod Expedition, in a bid to reach the pole itself. Now, on 9 January of 1909, the three companions, Shackleton reached 88 degrees, 23 minutes south, which was 180 kilometers from the pole itself. So every time they have to see how far they can go south in terms of understanding the actual land mass itself before being forced to turn back. Now, the first men to reach the geographic South Pole were the Norwegian Roald Amundsen and his party on 14 December of 1911. Now, there's a photo of Amundsen, Hansen, Hassel, and Wisting. These are the expedition members of, or the exploration members of Amundsen's party, as they had erected their little South Pole, little monument situation, which is just two flags and something that is, you know, pegged or held tight or upright. Now, Amundsen named his camp Polheim, and the entire plateau surrounding the pole, after the king, there's a king of theirs as King Hakon the Seventh Vidar, in honor of the Norwegian king Hakon the Seventh of Norway. Now, Robert Falcon Scott returned to Antarctica with his second expedition, the Terra Nova expedition, initially being unaware of Amundsen's secretive expedition. I don't know why you would call it secretive, because Amundsen doesn't have to go on and advertise that he's on this expedition. Now, Scott and four other men reached the South Pole on 17 January, literally a whole month later, Amundsen had been there on 17 January 1912, 34 days after Amundsen. Now, on the return trip, Scott and his four companions all died of starvation and of extreme cold. In 1914, Ernest Shackleton, the other particular guy that Scott had first partnered up with, returned once again with another expedition. This time, the Imperial Trans-Antarctic Expedition, that was set out with the goal of crossing the Antarctica via the South Pole. But his ship, the Endurance, was frozen in a pack and pack ice and sank 11 months later. The overland journey was never made. A U.S. admiral by the name of Richard Evelyn Byrd, with the assistance of his first pilot, Bernd Balchen, or Balchen, became the first person to fly over the South Pole on 29 November 1929. Exploration from 1950 to present. Now, it was not until 31 October 1956 that humans once again set foot at the South Pole, when a party led by an admiral, George Duffick, of the U.S. Navy, landed there in a specific aircraft known as a Skytrain aircraft. The U.S. Amundsen Scott South Pole Station was established by air over 1956 to 1957 for the International Geophysical Year, and has been continuously staffed since then by research and support personnel. Now, this obviously indicates, you know, that the easiest way to start things off was that you needed an airplane to land on the South Pole itself. And it's not safe to say that you can technically just fly there, even though it might be be easier to fly there, but the safest way to do this is by ship. Why? I'll explain why. There is something weird, obviously, as you heard, of what happens with the terrain in the South Pole. Meaning, the ice never melts. It always snows. The temperatures stay constant. A second scenario is obviously that the ice also moves. So, trying to have the exact coordinates of something at a continuous scenario makes it a little bit weird, because every year the coordinates have to be adjusted. I told you guys that technically speaking, there is no set time zone. Anyone can impose their time zone on the Antarctic, specifically on the South Pole. And that anyone that is there specifically has to recognize that the specific points move, except for the geographic South Pole. But certain particular points move every year. Now, so after Amundsen and Scott, the next people to actually reach the South Pole over land, and this was primarily with air support, so they came there by air, were specifically the gentleman by the name of Edmund Hillary, who on 4 January of 1958, and Vivian Fuchs from 19 January also of 1958, and their respective parties during the Commonwealth Trans-Antarctic Expedition. Now, there have been many subsequent expeditions to arrive at the South Pole by surface transportation. These included, obviously, those by Havola, Crary, and Fiennes. And the first group of women to reach the pole were Pam Young, Jean Pearson, Lewis Jones, and Eileen McSaveny, Kay Lindsay, and Teddy Tickhill. In 1969. But in 1978 to 1979, a woman by the name of Michelle Eileen Rainey became the first woman to winter at the South Pole. Now, to winter obviously means you stay through the winter season of this particular geographic area. And subsequent to the establishment in 1987 of the logistic support base, at the Patriot Hills Base Camp, the South Pole became more accessible to non-government expeditions. Now, currently, the pole station looks like a permanent structure. It's got buildings, double-story building and all that. Has got a layout in terms of, you know, various facilities around it. And obviously, it's a support station. And it obviously aims to help all other particular expeditions to also, you know, work from this particular station itself. Now, in 1988 to 1989, the Chilean glaciologist Alejo Contreras Steding reached the South Pole on foot. Before that, he had arrived in 1980 by other means. So, obviously, various aspects of exploration were still continuing to be done way past 1950. And then a lot of these were, you know, trying to sort of like say, hey, our country was here as well, and we stake a claim, and we are doing this, and we are doing that in these various components. So what was actually interesting was, just to let you know, dear listeners, that much of the discussions regarding the exploration activity were purely based on, if I can call it, should I call it, it was purely scientific in its right. Primarily because the explorations were done by scientists, and these particular scientists, had a particular scenario of, if I could say that they were there to research primarily to try and understand something. Research so far, has been a peculiar thing to technically look at. Why do I say this? Well, much of the research obviously has been about time zones, the ability to look at the stars, meaning space, as well as also trying to understand the various ecosystems and the conditions that the various animal, plant, and insect life, how they live in these particular conditions on the South Pole, how they actually conduct themselves. Now, when we look at these particular scenarios, they've obviously had to look at flora and fauna. Now, due to its exceptionally harsh climate, there are no native residents or resident plants or animals. Even though I said that there are animals there, specifically they find squaws or South Polar squaws. A South Polar squaw is a kind of a seabird. And they also find snow petrels, which is another kind of a seabird specifically. It is one of three known birds that have been seen at the geographic South Pole, along with the Antarctic petrel, and the South Polar squaw, which was the most southerly breeding sites of any bird inland in Antarctica. Another particular scenario is that there are islands on the way to the South Pole that also host certain particular kinds of animal life. In 2000, it was reported that microbes have been detected living in the South Pole ice. If you don't know what microbes are literally microorganisms, and these are microscopic in size. The scientists have published in the Journal of Gondwana Research, nothing to do with the company that exists in Namibia, just so that you know. The name Gondwana is an old name. It's a name given to another particular sort of like prehistoric formation of our continents. It's not the supercontinent that existed back then, Pangaea. Gondwana existed after Pangaea. Now, in the Journal of Gondwana Research, they gave evidence that had been found of dinosaurs with feathers that were present on this continent. And this was based on that these particular fossils that were found, obviously, was that these animals were trying to survive the extreme cold by adapting this way. So the moment an animal adapts feathers and various, or copious amounts of hair on the body, it's based upon the kinds of climatic conditions that they actually live within. Now, the fossils had been found over 100 years ago in Coonawarra, specifically in Australia, but in sediment which had accumulated under a lake which had been near to the South Pole millions of years ago. So obviously, in terms of identifying animal life and these particular things, it makes it difficult for the scientists to try and establish this. Now, the winter period for the South Pole is literally our winter period, from May to August. The South Pole also receives no sunlight at all, and it is completely dark, apart from the moonlight during nighttime. In the summer, which is its October through to February period, which is our summer as well, the sun is continuously above the horizon and appears to move from left to right. However, it is always relatively low in the sky, reaching a maximum of approximately 23.5 degrees around the December solstice because of the approximately 23.5 degree tilt of the Earth's axis at that time. Now, much of the sunlight that does reach the surface is reflected by the white snow. This lack of warmth from the sun, combined with the high altitude of about 2,800 meters, means that the South Pole has one of the coldest climates on Earth, although it is not quite the coldest. That record still goes to the region in the vicinity of the Vostok Station, also in the Antarctica, which lies at a higher elevation. And if you guys did not know, the higher you go, the colder it gets in the sky. If from the surface of the Earth into the sky, the higher you go, the colder it gets. I tell you this with utmost, what they call that word, confidence and proof of this particular scenario, and every time I've experienced it, it is a fact. Even if you're on a mountain, if you go and climb a mountain, the higher you go, the colder it becomes. I was on Table Mountain in Cape Town. the higher you go, the colder it gets. I was in the city of Shanghai's highest building, which technically could be one of the tallest buildings in the world. And the higher you go, the colder it gets. I was in, you could see on airplanes, specifically if you open up the shutter, on the airplane window, how icicles form on the windows of the airplane. The higher you go, the colder it gets. No matter, even if someone comes and asks you a question, but the higher you go, would you not be closer to the sun rays? No. You would not be. The setting obviously being that you've got to also understand how long it takes for a ray of sunlight to get from where it is produced to where it is reaching. So, we quickly take a short break, dear listeners, and after the musical break, we come back heading into the rest of this morning's program here on your number one talk radio station. That is My Sunday Morning Take here on Eagle FM.
Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world.
Coming back there from the sound specifically of New Guinea and of the song that they produced, obviously, by the name of Marekia. We're getting to the quite entertaining part of our discussion for this morning. Now, the quite entertaining part brings us back to the International Antarctic Treaty System, or the Antarctic Treaty System as it is sometimes known. So, remember when I explained to you guys that currently the Antarctic Treaty has 58 parties that are signatory to it, and that it's got like 55 Antarctic research stations based on the continent itself? Well, developments obviously have taken place, you know, in all the time since the 1940s up until now. Reason being that in the 1940s, just after World War II, the US considered establishing a claim in Antarctica. Why? Well, from 26 August of 1946 until the beginning of 1947, the Americans carried out Operation High Jump. It was the largest military expeditionary force that the US had ever sent to Antarctica, and it consisted of like 13 ships, 4,700 men, and numerous aerial devices. The main aim of this particular expeditionary mission was to train military personnel and to test material in conditions of extreme cold for a hypothetical war in the Antarctic. On 2 September of 1947, the quadrant of Antarctica in which the US was interested in, that was between the latitude or the coordinates of 24 degrees west and 90 degrees west, was included as part of the security zone of the Inter-American Treaty of Reciprocal Assistance, committing its members to defend it in case of external aggression. In August of 1948, the US proposed that Antarctica be under the guardianship of the United Nations as a trust territory administered by Argentina, Australia, Chile, France, the US, the UK, and New Zealand. This idea was rejected by Argentina, Australia, Chile, France, and Norway, and before the rejection, on 28 August of 1948, the US proposed to the claimant countries some form of internationalization of Antarctica, and the UK supported this. Chile responded by presenting a plan to suspend all Antarctic claims for 5 to 10 years while negotiating a final solution, but this did not find acceptance as well. So, heading into 1950, the interest of the US to keep the Soviet Union away from Antarctica was frustrated when the Soviets informed the claimant states that they would not accept any Antarctic agreement in which they were not represented. Now, the fear that the USSR would react by making a territorial claim, bringing the Cold War to Antarctica, led the US to make no claim. So, this then leads to the discussion, obviously, of potential international conflicts that obviously would arise, because you can obviously see how the negotiation processes had been ongoing. So, various international conflicts actually motivated the creation of an agreement for the Antarctic. And this was the precise reason as to why Eisenhower, reacted the way he did when I explained at the start of this morning's discussion that it was Eisenhower who went like, you know what, let's avoid bringing any international conflicts we have with each other to this continent. So some incidents have occurred during the Second World War, and a new one occurred in Hope Bay. This is primarily on the South Pole. In Hope Bay on 1 February of 1952. And this was when the Argentine military fired warning shots at a group of Britons. The response of the UK was to send a warship that landed Marines at the scene on 4 February. Literally 3 days later. In 1949, Argentina, Chile, and the UK signed a tripartite naval declaration committing not to send warships south of the 60th parallel south line, which was renewed annually until 1961 when it was deemed unnecessary when the treaty entered into force. Now, this tripartite declaration was signed after the tension generated when Argentina sent a fleet of 8 warships to Antarctica in February of 1948. On 17 January of 1953, Argentina reopened the Lieutenant La Sala refuge on Deception Island. Yes, this island's name is literally Deception Island. Deception Island obviously being, you know, pretty close to Antarctica itself. Deception Island is one of those islands that have some of the animal life that I mentioned a little bit earlier. So Deception Island is close. It is literally close to the South Pole or to the peninsula itself, but it is not attached to the South Pole. You'll find it there on the way to the South Pole. So Deception Island is part of the South Shetland Islands, close to the Antarctica, Antarctic Peninsula, with a large and usually safe natural harbor, which is occasionally affected by the underlying active volcano. The reason why they named it Deception Island, obviously, is because it's an active volcano still. This island is the caldera of an active volcano, which seriously damaged local scientific stations in 1967. There is like a docking station situation at Deception Island, but everyone knows now specifically that this active volcano is an issue, and having a research station based at Deception Island makes things peculiar, because it obviously would have been nice if it was just a dormant volcano, but no, it had to be active. So when this, obviously getting back to the international conflict scenario, was that in 1953, in January, Argentina reopened the Lieutenant La Sala refuge on Deception Island, leaving a sergeant and a corporal in the Argentine Navy. Now, on 15 February, in the incident on Deception Island, a 32 Royal Marines from the British frigate HMS Snipe landed on Deception Island, armed with 10 machine guns, rifles, and tear gas capturing the 2 Argentine sailors. Now, the Argentine refuge and a nearby uninhabited Chilean shelter were destroyed, and the Argentine sailors were delivered to a ship from that country on 18 February near South Georgia. Now, a British detachment remained for three months on the island, while the frigate patrolled its waters until April of that year. On 4 May 1955, the UK filed 2 lawsuits against Argentina and Chile, respectively, before the International Court of Justice. Wow, look at them. And this was to declare the invalidity of the claims of sovereignty of the 2 countries over Antarctic and the sub-Antarctic areas. So, by 15 July of 1959, the Chilean government rejected the jurisdiction of the court in that case, and on 1 August, the Argentine government also did so. On 16 March 1956, the claims were closed. In 1956 and 1958, India tried unsuccessfully to bring the Antarctic issue to the UN General Assembly. And this obviously was the aspect in terms of the conflicts that were observed. Let's take things a little bit forward, because heading from conflicts, which obviously meant that armies and navies and air forces were involved, to like the reason for the treaty itself, under which Eisenhower called the treaty to be, you know, to be established, was another particular thing. So you had the International Geophysical Year that I mentioned at the start of the discussion. This geophysical year was actually known as the International Council of Scientific Unions, or it was something that the International Council of Scientific Unions had or was celebrating or had introduced, for that matter. And the ICSU had discussed the possibility of holding a 3rd international polar year. And this was in 1950. Now, at the suggestion of the World Meteorological Organization, which is also another UN organization, the idea of the International Polar Year was extended to the entire planet. Thus, it created the International Geophysical Year that took place between 1 July of 1957 to 31 December of 1958. In this event, 66 countries actually anticipated. At the ICSU meeting in Stockholm between 9 to 11 September 1957, the creation of a special committee for Antarctic research, known as SCAR, was approved. This invited the 12 countries that were conducting Antarctic investigations to send delegates to integrate the committee. And this was with the purpose of exchanging scientific information among these members regarding the Antarctica. Now, SCAR was later renamed to the Scientific Committee for Research in Antarctica. Now, both Argentina and Chile stated that research carried out on the continent during the International Geophysical Year would not give any territorial rights to participants, and that the facilities that were erected during that year should be dismantled at the end of that particular year. However, in February of 1958, the US proposed that the Antarctic investigations should be extended for another year, and the Soviet Union reported that it would maintain its scientific basis until the studies being carried out had been completed. Obviously, as you can see how countries act, you know, one country gives a suggestion and another country goes like, you know what, but I think my guys are not done yet, so we'll stay there for as long as possible. Now, this then obviously leads to how this treaty was set forth or introduced or proposed. The scientific basis increased international tension concerning the Antarctica. The danger of the Cold War actually spreading to the continent caused the President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower, to convene an Antarctic conference of the 12 countries active in Antarctica during the International Geophysical Year. This meant the aim was to sign a treaty. Now, in the first phase, the representatives of the 12 nations met in Washington, D.C., who met in the 60 sessions between June of 1958 to October of 1959. And this was to define a basic negotiating framework. However, no consensus was reached on a preliminary draft. In the second phase, a conference at the highest diplomatic level was held from 15 October to 1 December of 1959 when the treaty was signed. Now, the Antarctic Treaty was signed in 1959 by 12 nations, and it literally came into effect on 23 June 1961. Now, the central ideas with full acceptance were the freedom of scientific research in Antarctica and the peaceful use of the continent. Now, you would ask yourself, where have you heard such language before? Well, I'll tell you where you've heard such language before, specifically with the ongoing negotiations of the peaceful use of outer space that is being negotiated by all member states at the UN level. And those negotiations obviously are based upon that no one should send weapons into space in order to be used or redirected back to the surface of the Earth. No one should send problematic hardware that has the capability of impacting countries on the surface of the Earth. When I'm saying problematic hardware, I'm talking about scenarios where you are potentially using spy satellites and various other kinds of satellites potentially that could be armed with ammunition or with firearms or with anything else that has the potential to cause damage on the surface of the Earth. And it's been one of the discussions probably as to what I think has been the problematic scenario, in terms of that there's been a program that the United States has been trying to get off the ground, but this program is bogged down because we are all negotiating for the peaceful use of outer space. The idea is not to be using any form of hardware specifically to target each other. But obviously, as you know, the developed countries and the developed North, it makes things problematic. I mean, just to give you insights, that I was party to a presentation that was given there to the particular excursion that I went to in China, specifically of how international plane manufacturing companies treat developing countries, where they would charge triple the amount of money just for experts to come and consult for you. They would charge triple the amount in terms of technology sharing initiatives. They would charge, not they would give it for free. They would charge. They would put down conditions and stipulations in some contractual formats so as to restrict you, or actually restrict your ability to be able to be self-sufficient, for that matter, all under the guise of international trade and all under the guise of, you know, fair trade indications in that scenario. So it obviously makes things a little bit problematic. Now, the reason why I mentioned this is specifically that you get to see the level of, if I can call it, belligerence of countries. Well, here's the thing. If you are a sovereign state, you would obviously defend your state's interests. You would defend your country, your nation's interests. One of the downsides has always been is that you can clearly see that much of this negotiation is built upon, is based upon a scenario of, I've also got an army, so you won't be able to tell me what to do with my life and direction and stuff like that. Now, bringing you back on point specifically to where we left off with our discussion was obviously that, as mentioned, the idea was to ensure that the treaty needs, needs to keep in focus the main aim as to why many of these participating nations are on the South Pole. They're there for research and development. So the Antarctic Treaty was signed in 1959 by 12 nations, and it came into effect on 23 June 1961. The central ideas were that received full acceptance was the freedom of scientific research in Antarctica. And the peaceful use of the continent. There was also a consensus for demilitarization and the maintenance of the status quo. Now, the treaty prohibits nuclear testing, military operations, economic exploitation, and territorial claims in Antarctica. It is monitored through on-site inspections, and also that the only permanent structures allowed are scientific research stations. That's it. Those are the only permanent structures allowed. The original signatory countries hold voting rights on Antarctica's governance, or on Antarctic governance, with seven of them claiming portions of the continent and the remaining five being non-claimants. Other nations have joined as consultative members by conducting significant research in Antarctica. The non-consultative parties can also adhere to the treaty. By 1991 to 1992, the treaty was renegotiated by 33 nations, with the main change being the Madrid Protocol on Environmental Protection, which prohibited mining and oil exploration for 50 years on the Antarctic, or in the Antarctic. Now, the positions of the US, the Soviet Union, which does not exist anymore, which is now represented by Russia, the UK and New Zealand coincided in the establishment of an international administration for Antarctica, proposing that it should be within the framework of the UN. Now, Australia and the UK expressed the need for inspections by observers, and the British also proposed the use of military personnel for logistical functions. Now, Argentina proposed that all atomic explosions be banned in Antarctica. Good on Argentina, which caused a crisis that lasted until the last day of the conference, since the US, along with other countries, intended to ban only those that were made without prior notice and without prior consultation. Good on Argentina. Pretty good. I mean, it's a good stipulation to put there to literally keep all nuclear testing away from the continent. Now, the support of the USSR and of Chile for the Argentine proposal finally caused the US to retract its opposition. The signing of the treaty was the first arms control agreement that occurred in the framework of the Cold War. And the participating countries managed to actually avoid the internationalization of Antarctic sovereignty. Now, starting from the year 2048, any of the consultative parties to the treaty may request the revision of the treaty and its entire normative system with the approval of 3/4 majority of consultative parties that will be needed for the adoption of these changes. So, actually, good on Argentina for actually putting in that stipulation to ban all nuclear testing. That was a pretty good move. But yeah, so there are other agreements, obviously, that also sign into or facilitate into or factor into the overall Antarctic treaty. There is an indication that other agreements, some 200 recommendations that were adopted at treaty consultative meetings and that were ratified by the governments includes, for example, the agreed measures for the conservation of Antarctic fauna and flora from 1964. It came into force in 1982. The Convention for the Conservation of Antarctic Seals in 1972. The Convention for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources came into effect in 1982. The Convention on the Regulation of Antarctic Mineral Resource Activities of 1988. Signed in 1988. But according to the literature resource, it is not in force. The Protocol on Environmental Protection to the Antarctic Treaty was signed in 1991. It came into force in 1998. This agreement prevents development and provides for the protection of Antarctic of the Antarctic environment through 5 specific annexes on marine pollution, fauna and flora, environmental impact assessment, waste management, and protected areas. It prohibits all activities relating to mineral resources except for scientific purposes. A 6th annex on liability arising from environmental emergencies was adopted in 2005, but this is also yet to enter into force. Then there's also a bunch of bilateral treaties that obviously sign into this particular discussion, because you've got treaties signed between the governments of Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, as well as also the French Republic, regarding aerial navigation in the Antarctic. This was something that they signed in 1938 already in Paris. And obviously this was a scenario in terms of, you know, how do we fly over, the South Pole. Then there was a treaty between the governments of Australia and of the French Republic on cooperation in the maritime areas adjacent to the French Southern and Antarctic territories. And also close to Heard Island and the McDonald Islands. This was obviously signed in Australia in 2003. Then finally, the agreement on cooperative enforcement of fisheries laws between the government of Australia and the government of the French Republic in the maritime areas adjacent to the French Southern and Antarctic territories, Heard Island and the McDonald Islands, signed in Paris in 2007. So, these particular indications obviously highlight, dear listeners, that there is a significant amount of people, that, or countries rather, that are signatories to the participation, observation, and research of Antarctica. Bad news. Namibia is not one of them. Actually, the whole of Africa, except for South Africa, is not part to this treaty. Namibia could have a claim, just like South Africa. Reason being is that you firstly need to be able to send a mission there. Meaning you need ships, you need personnel, and you need the ability, you must have the ability to be able to send an expeditionary force there to go set up a research station. Now, obviously, this highlights to anyone that a discussion of having access to a piece of this continent to the south of Africa is a bit weird, since it's uninhabited and since it only has weird plant life and animal life that sometimes is migratory. And primarily that the reason that everyone is there is so that everyone is there to look at everyone else and observe and monitor what everyone else is doing while you're also there. So South Africa has consulting status. They're a state party with consulting status. Them, China, I see Mongolia is there as well. Japan is there as well. India is there as well. Brazil also has the status. I think that is Finland and Sweden. Spain has the status. Spain and Portugal. Germany has the status as well. The obvious state parties with consulting status making a claim to the Antarctic territory includes countries like I mentioned, Argentina, Australia, New Zealand for some reason. South Africa should have thrown in a hat there as well. State parties with consulting status reserving the right to make a territorial claim includes obviously Russia, obviously the United States. I don't see that Norway has that status claim, but obviously Russia and Norway would, you know, do what they do in that scenario. And then the other state parties with consulting status obviously would be the ones that I mentioned a little bit earlier in terms of the guys that come through in the forms of South Africa, Brazil, India, China, Japan, and so on. Now, that unfortunately, dear listeners, does bring us up to the end of our discussion for this morning's session of My Sunday Morning Take here on your number one talk radio station. We'll be signing out on the other side of this musical break. And on that note, stay tuned for the rest of the programming here on your number one talk radio station of Eagle FM, as we obviously take you through the rest of your Sunday morning programming in our company. On that note, enjoy the rest of your programming in our company. And remember that obviously, wherever you find yourself, I hope you guys have the same particularly awesome weather that we are enjoying. And on that note, let's see each other again, same time, same place, next week or during the course of the week on The Home Run.
Time, inspiration hard to find. Across the Rio Grande, take me to your city lights, out by the riverside. I know you understand. Play me something down tempo, low key and rock steady. Body hitting like Kimbo, falling for you like confetti. More whiskey and ginger, now I'm just the beginner. But if I stayed in the middle, just one more night, just one more night. I know a girl with a diamond crown, grew up in a border town, took me to an empty dive. Such a pretty silhouette, show me how to two-step. She brings me back to life. Play me something down tempo, low-key and rock-steady. Body hitting like Kimbo, falling for you like confetti. More whiskey and ginger, love, I'm just a beginner. What if I stayed in the middle? Just one more night, just one more night. Oh, oh, na, na, na. Oh yeah. Down tempo, low key and rock steady. Body hitting like Kimbo, falling for you like confetti. More whiskey and ginger, love, I'm just a beginner. What if I stayed in the middle? Just one more night, just one more night.
come back, dear listeners. We're about 13 seconds out from the quick ad break and the end of this morning's particular session. We'll quickly just be stepping into the ad break and sing our goodbyes on the other side of this.
Esira shisho, pagyotari kupasere opovoro kara uasira yakweni ochisho. Watuchi itana basic mental health first aid course. Taiganjua oshari jamhongi kwa mboka iri iyo iyo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo na kene una okutongorora omajidiriko ugopetameko ugenacha nupiakazi nenge omafidakano omavirabiro kuchane omokatiko kumekoe nenge anironga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo kene una okwea kwa sera nukwea pa ea bidido yiri mwonjira omanga upia kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere o unji na kene unokara uishangitha tarera po epanja yao yo nhp.com.na e hangono maradura sano odobina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you
your health your life your peace of mind NHP, we're about you.
Musical break right there, dear listeners. And ultimately, we have to say our goodbyes. And obviously, let's see each other again during the course of the week. Remember to stay tuned for the rest of your programming to follow on after the break. And on that note, let's see each other again, same time, same place. This has been my Sunday morning take for this Sunday morning session here on Eagle FM. We'll see each other again, same time, same place next week, or alternatively, during the course of the week on the Home Run.